Well, welcome everyone to the National Storytelling Network's Storytelling and Organization Story Lab call. Today is November 20th, 2016, and our guest today is Laura Packer. And our topic is finding work when the world doesn't get what we do. Word of mouth, social media, and other ways to find work. And I'm just going to take a second. This is Tom Sparrow, one of the board members of the SIO, to read just a little bit about Laura. Laura Packer runs a business called Think Story, and you can find it at thinkstory.com. Her storytelling work has brought her some big-name clients, such as Quest Diagnostics, iRobot Corporation, and NASA. She's a recipient of the 2010 NSN Oracle Award for Outstanding Contributions to Storytelling and the 2012 Lane's Brother Blue Award. Laura performs, runs venues, coaches, writes, and helps individuals find their voice and use their story to make the world a better place. And if you link in with her or you visit her website, or you sign up for her blog, you'll see that she's very organized, coherent, and a great example of a storyteller working with organizations. And we're thrilled to have her as our guest today. Welcome, Laura.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here. And I have to say, after that introduction, I feel as though I should just say, and that says it all, because it's a lot to live up to. So thank you. So I thought I would start by telling you a little bit about how I got into this work, and then talking a little bit about how I get work. And at any point, if you have questions or anything like that, please chime in. I find conference call etiquette to sometimes be a little bit challenging, so forgive me if I talk over you accidentally. It's not an intentional slight. So does that sound reasonable?
Yes, that sounds great.
Okay, great.
Awesome.
All right, so I have been a performing storyteller for, how old am I, for 25 years now, which seems like an impossibly long time. I came into it kind of as part of the family business. My mother was a children's librarian. My father was a writer, so I grew up really surrounded by spoken story, by oral story, and loved it. And I told stories to my friends. I pursued a degree in folklore and mythology from Boston University. And then when I was in my mid-20s, early 20s, I found out that Brother Blue was hosting a storytelling circle. I went to that and my life was instantaneously changed. And I will assume that most of you at least know who Brother Blue was, and so you understand what a life-changing experience it was becoming friends with him. And he became my mentor. I was very fortunate.
In case there are some folks who don't know who Brother Blue is, just say a little bit about that and how that affected you immediately.
So Brother Blue, he died in 2009. Brother Blue was African-American. He was born in Cleveland, Ohio. He was an officer in World War II and then got his bachelor's degree at Harvard, his master's at Yale, and his doctorate at Harvard. And I'm telling you that because you can imagine what it was like for a man who was of an age to be an officer in World War II to pursue that kind of education as an African-American person. It tells you something about the quality of his mind. And that's easy to lose sight of if you met Blue, because Blue's presentation of himself was very deliberately and very consciously as a holy fool. So Brother Blue was a masterful storyteller. His storytelling was influenced by jazz and by scat musicians and by people, by poetry, by the oldest myths, and by the people he met every day. His wife, Ruth Hill, is the person who grounded him, who gave him the place, the room to run and the room to play. He was the best listener I have ever met in my entire life. And I've met some wonderful listeners, but he listened to people with such passion and such integrity that merely by being listened to by Brother Blue, you became a better storyteller. And he believed that storytelling had the power to save the world, because he would say over and over again, if you listen to someone's story, how could you shoot them? Which I think is a pretty powerful statement. So I met Blue, and most people who met Blue either thought he was nuts and ran away, and, you know, he was on the borderline of what we might call sane in this culture, or they were absolutely entranced, and I was entranced. And I became one of the people who sat at his feet and listened to the stories that he told and learned from him. This is not directly related to my organizational work, because Blue didn't do organizational storytelling, but what he passionately believed was that story had application everywhere. And he saw possibility in everyone to be a storyteller and to communicate more effectively and to make a powerful mark on the world by being authentic to themselves and telling stories that were authentic to who they were.
Yeah. So it must have been really something to receive the Lane's Brother Blue Award.
Oh, I was sobbing. I actually was one of the people who instigated the award prior to his death, a few years before he died. And my husband, Kevin Brooks, and I were co-granted the award after his death, but his wife was one of the people who gave it to us. And it was a very powerful, very meaningful thing. Mm. Yes.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for taking that little
detour
there.
Those of you who don't know Blue, I would urge you to go to YouTube and type in Brother Blue Storyteller. Most of the videos of him that are there are kind of after he was in his peak performance years, but it will give you a sense of who he is. And he's worth seeing. He really is. So after I'd been telling stories, performing stories for maybe 5 or 6 years, a friend called me up and told me that she worked in an organization where women were having a great deal of difficulty being heard and getting their voices heard over the fray, that when they tried to speak up, they were being told that they were being strident or bitchy. And she wanted some help thinking through how the women in her organization could be heard without being immediately relegated to the whiny box. And I looked at her and said, I have no idea how to do that. What are you talking about? And she said, you're a storyteller. You know how to communicate. And I was terrified, but I said yes. And that's how I started getting involved in organizational storytelling, because my first gig was at NASA. So I had to really step up to the plate. I was one of the very first storytellers in NASA. So it was a real honor to be there and to help lay the groundwork for their future storytelling efforts, which have been substantial. It's an organization that really gets at storytelling matters. So I worked with NASA, and as soon as I did that first gig, which I called Stand Up and Speak Out, I realized that this was amazing work to be doing. I love performing, I love teaching, I love coaching, I'm good at all of those. But with organizational work, I get to marry both the logical problem-solving part of my mind and the performative, creative part of my mind. And it was just thrilling. So then I started taking workshops, taking classes, reading everything I could find, and began to approach organizations and say, I'm learning how to do this. I would like to do some work with you, but because I'm learning, could I do this as a test case? So I approached organizations where I had friends who were involved in the organization, people who would vouch for me. So I did maybe half a dozen free gigs for small businesses and small nonprofits, and then got feedback on what worked and what didn't. And the whole time I was talking to people like Doug Lippman and others who were doing organizational work and bouncing ideas around with them. And that's how I started. What then started happening was the people with whom I worked, for whom I did these free gigs, started telling people in other organizations about me, because what I was doing was useful. And word of mouth began to spread. And I have to be entirely honest with you, I was terrified. I was petrified that I was getting these calls from good-sized both foreign nonprofits saying, we need help with storytelling. Can you come help us? And I felt like I had no idea what I was doing. I felt like I was a fake. I felt like an imposter. I still struggle with that sometimes. But then I figured, it's easy for a juggler to juggle, and we watch a juggler and we're awed, or we watch someone on a tightrope and we're awed, or we watch a physicist and we think, I could never do that. But for them, they can, because they've been practicing and working and doing it. And by this time, I'd been doing storytelling for 10, 12 years. And I realized that I had a skill set that was valuable to organizations. And because I'm an effective teacher and I can communicate well in business settings as well as in nonprofit settings, that I had something that I could go with. So I began to actually start putting myself out there. And I'll get to how I put myself out there, most of which was highly ineffective initially. So actually, I'll tell you that now. The first set of things I did is I tried running some ads, which got me nothing. I tried running ads in a number of journals and on some websites. I then began writing articles, and that began to get some interest. It didn't directly lead to work. But what has been one of my most effective methods for getting work is presenting workshops at conferences or doing free workshops with business organizations, so nonprofit umbrella organizations, or if you have a startup community in your city, going to the startup community and offering a free workshop. I don't let free workshops be longer than an hour. They're an hour and 90 minutes at the most. I make sure that they will leave with something useful, but if they want more, they need to get in touch with me. And almost every time I offer a free workshop, I get paid work out of it, which then leads to more word of mouth work, which then leads to more work in general. Throughout all of this, I continued to work with NASA. I was also by that time working with iRobot, the Society for Information Management. I had done some work with Big Brothers and Big Sisters, a number of other nonprofits, and I was finding that nonprofits were really where I was thrilled, but you earn more money if you're working with the for-profits. I began to think about how do I work with for-profits in a way that feels ethical and authentic to me. And then I made the biggest career mistake I have yet made. I'm sure I will make others that are just as big. And I'm telling you about this because that way when you make your mistake, and you will, you can remember that you're not the only one. I was doing this workshop with NASA. I was being invited back on an annual basis to go to different NASA sites around the country to do work with them. This had been going on for 5 or 6 years at that point. And I was invited to a NASA site on Wallops Island in Virginia. And I went and I did the workshop I always did. And part of that workshop included telling a story. And I'm going to use accurate terms for parts of the male body now. And it's not prurient, but I need you to understand what happened. So if anybody's sensitive, step off the call for just a moment. Part of the workshop included telling a story about when I was 5 years old and I wanted to be a paleontologist, a fireman, and the president, and I was told I could do none of those because I was a girl. And at five, I had a rudimentary understanding of the difference between boys and girls, and I knew that boys had penises, so I made one out of toilet paper and taped it on, figuring that at that point I could do anything. If you want to laugh at that, it's okay. It's actually a funny story. But I told that story. I told it to a group of all women. I had told it repeatedly in NASA workshops before. I told it in other settings, and it had always been greeted with great enjoyment and an understanding that what I was talking about was sexism and how sexism can affect us and how we need to find creative solutions around it. After the workshop was over, I got a letter from the organizers saying, our participants found you to be rude and inappropriate because you used the P word. You will not be invited back to NASA. So that was devastating. That was personally wrenching because I'd done it before and I was excited about the work and I felt like an idiot. But what happened is I hadn't taken into account that I was south of the Mason-Dixon line. I was in the South and I was talking to a bunch of engineers and highly educated women, some of whom were also considered themselves Southern ladies. And it was my mistake that I didn't take that into account. It was not their fault. It was a mistake where I didn't read the audience accurately. So it's been a painful lesson, and I'm telling you that now so that you can all learn from my uncomfortable mistake. But what it taught me was that organizational work is just like any other kind of storytelling work, that you need to do your homework ahead of time and understand your audience so that you can approach them in a way that where they can meet you. Someone asked me a number of years ago about doing work with businesses, and they said, well, how do you dress? And I said, I put on a suit if I'm going into a business setting. And his response was, but don't you want to shake them up? Don't you want them to see that the world can be different? This was another acolyte of Brother Blues who never would have worn a suit. But I said, I do, but I want them to be able to accept me from the start. They're not going to be able to hear my message if I walk in there and I'm challenging them with the way I'm dressed from the outset. So that was part of the lesson that I learned from my NASA mistake. Does anybody have any questions so far?
I have a comment that is very similar to what Ed Stuyvesant said in his workshop this summer of success in your storytelling work had to do with a few elements, and one of the elements was paying careful attention of who you were telling to or who you're working with. And if you don't do that and things fall flat, it's your own fault, because there's a kind of science in creating just the right material for just the right group, and you have to know who the group is to do that.
What it comes back to again is what we all know as performers, which is the audience is crucial. And our job as performers is not just to practice our craft and to work hard and to learn things and to make sure we are as skilled and exercise our talent as best we can, but to make sure that the audience is welcome, even if we're doing something that will challenge them, because they're not going to play with us if they don't feel welcome. So in all of my workshops, at some point, I will ask them to do something uncomfortable, which is usually around listening. But I make sure that prior to that, they have a place where they can fit in, that I've created a safe space in the workshop. And I think that's part of why I have good word of mouth, because I do challenge people in businesses and nonprofits to do things they haven't done before. But at the same time, I do my best to make sure that they understand that they are in a safe environment and to create that safe environment. So that's actually feedback that I consistently get now. And I think that's part of what good word of mouth is, that you are both able to challenge and create that air of safety, that people will talk about you if they feel like they were pushed in a way that was not too risky.
Yeah.
So how do I get work?
Laura? Laura?
Yeah.
This is Mark
yes.
Goldman. Can you back up for just half a second? And
sure.
I may have missed it. How do you create that safe place, safe space?
I start by spending some time on didactic materials. So I go over the neurology of storytelling. I go over applications. I go over some of that black and white stuff that is very fact-based. So that helps break through the idea that storytelling is something too soft and mushy, which is very useful when you're dealing with executives whose time is very valuable, or if you're dealing with engineers, and I do a lot of work in technology firms. So starting in that fact-based place helps establish your veracity. It helps establish your expertise. And then when I get to the part about listening, the first listening exercise that I have them do is always a very easy one. It's talk about a time when you succeeded at work, or talk about something that you love, but specifically not a person. I have them talk about an item or an activity or a place that they love, and I have them do that in one-on-one pairs. So it's
right.
Something pleasurable. It's not, they're not being asked to talk about anything difficult. So that establishes safety from the outset.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome. And I also talk about safety. I talk about how I'm going to be asking them to do something that's really hard. And I always say, listening stuff, it's really hard. So when it's actually not that bad, they feel like they've achieved something. So they have an easy success right at the front. So that when we do get to the more difficult topics, a time when your organization was struggling with an issue, and the stories around that struggle, they've already established that they know how to listen to one another, they know how to support one another, and that it's safe to do so, that no one's going to laugh at you. And they've started from a place of success.
Great.
So the first way at this point in my career that I get work is through word of mouth. And I make a reasonably good living from consulting, by mostly because I work with an organization and they recommend me to someone else. I also have continued to do probably 5 or 6 times a year. I try to go to a conference, not a storytelling conference, and do a workshop on storytelling. Realistically, I think it's probably more like 3 or 4 times a year. I strive for 5 to 6 times a year. So I go to design conferences. I go to technology conferences. I go to marketing conferences, things like that, and do a workshop on some specific application of storytelling. This is not free. As you know, it's costly to go to conferences. But if I go to a conference and if I get one well-paid gig out of it, I've more than made up my expenses. And if I get that one good gig and I do a good job and they talk about it, then it is absolutely a profitable experience. So I have found that it's worth it going to conferences, and it's worth it doing these introduction to storytelling workshops at professional development groups. So I do a lot of these in nonprofit umbrella groups. Like in Kansas City, it's an organization called Nonprofit Connect. I often also go to nonprofit conferences. I did one at the Boston Architectural Association meeting. I went to one of their meetings, and that led to work. I did one for the Society for Information Management 10 years ago, maybe 12 years ago, something like that. That has led to my being part of a training program that they're doing, where I'm working with the 20 to 30 top up-and-coming IT executives in the country. And they then are bringing me into their organizations. But that was from a free gig that I did 10 years ago. And that's still making me a nice chunk of my income. So I find that to be very useful. I have learned how, although you might not believe it from this conversation, this lecture that I'm giving you, that I've learned how to have pretty good pitches around storytelling whenever I'm talking to someone. And I always have business cards, always. I keep them in my wallet. I have them in my purse. I stick them in my pocket. I don't go anywhere without a business card. And if I hope you all have business cards. So I've developed a pretty good pitch. And what usually happens is I'm, for example, sitting next to someone on an airplane, and you know how you settle in and you talk for 30 seconds and then you hope that you're not going to talk anymore. But part of that 30-second conversation is often, where are you going and why are you going there? And what I tend to do is I just listen. I will listen to them. And at some point, they'll run out of stuff to say, and they ask, what are you doing? And I tell them why I'm going there. And then I add in, you know, you mentioned, for example, that you are a construction site manager. I'm a storyteller, and I'm interested in what kinds of, how do you guys communicate around the site around dangerous issues? So I'll ask a question, which can then lead to a conversation. I also have an elevator pitches, and I'm sure you've already done work on how to have an effective elevator pitch. But I find that by listening and then asking the right question, that can lead to a conversation, which can lead to work. I've gotten a fair bit of work out of these airport conversations, the waiting for the bus conversation, I'm in a hotel bar and I'm having a drink and chatting with the person next to me conversation. What is far more effective for me than trying to give them a pitch is listening to them and then asking a question, because that gets them engaged. And I can usually offer them some kind of very small solution when they're talking about communication issues. And by offering them a very small solution in that moment, they remember me. And I then don't hear from them for 6 months or a year, but then I eventually get a call. So I give a lot of things away for free. There is a lot of debate about the free economy, so I'm very careful about what I give away for free, the stuff at conferences, these free workshops, the little conversations. I will even meet someone for a cup of coffee and have a conversation with them. But that's as far as it goes. I won't go into an organization and work for it for free. They have to pay me something, which brings us to perceived value. Is this useful? Do you have questions before I go?
Yes, because, Laura, earlier I thought that you said, and maybe this is just something that you did when you were first getting started, that you had offered a series of things to different nonprofits just to see what was working and mm-hmm. how it was going. So that was early on, but at this point, you don't do that anymore.
Yeah. At this point, I don't do that anymore. At this point, what I do, as I said, is I do these free workshops, and that's often where I try out new material. Huh. Is this exercise going to work? Huh, I have a free workshop scheduled. I'm going to try it there. I make sure that it's always sandwiched around things that I know work, so that this is me looking for work, so I don't want people to go away thinking that I'm incompetent, but I'll try something new there. I also, at this point, have relationships with the people for whom I have worked. And that's vital, vitally important to build these relationships. So after you do the gig, you send the thank you note. You ask them if it was useful to them. You ask them, is there anything that you would like? Do you have any follow-up questions? I don't usually say, is there anything that you wish I had included? But I'll ask if they have follow-up questions. And then I answer them and do as thorough a job as I can. I also usually give them a PDF of my slides so that they can have it for reference. I don't give them the slides themselves because I don't want people to just be able to easily swipe the slides outright. Sometimes I know they've recreated them, but I will give them the PDF. Yeah.
Laura, this is Tricia speaking, and when you touched on that, that's something that I kind of always struggle with, is like how much information to give. I mean, I can give information and engage in dialogue.
Hold on just a minute. I'm sorry, hold on. Yes? I'm on my call. I'm back, sorry.
Okay, no problem. So you mentioned that you'll use slides and you'll give them a PDF. Are those pretty much your handouts?
No, I usually have an additional handout that I email to them. I
afterwards?
Rarely give it to them afterwards. Oh, okay. I never give out handouts at the beginning because if I do, they're just going to spend all their time looking at the handouts. Unless it's a workbook that is designed for them to be filling out as we go through the workshop, which I will occasionally develop.
Yeah.
I'm working on a piece with Quest right now where they want to have a workbook. So I've put together, I think it's up to about 25 pages. So it's a pretty lengthy workbook that they're going to have in front of them. But I will have to address that whole, I know it's very tempting to just go through the workbook right now, but if you don't mind, let's go through it as a group. So I address those things. I do have handouts. I usually email them because, one, I get really tired of printing out a zillion sheets of paper or wasting the paper, quite frankly. And two, if I email it, then they all have my contact information in their email. So it's a way to have me more accessible to them.
Okay, great.
And I can include links. I embed links. Mm-hmm. I usually will embed a link in an electronic handout to some article that I've written.
I find the other part, too, when you send something to them email-wise, is that I'm big on meeting commitments to people, so you promise to send them something, and you make your promise. A very simple thing to do, but it starts immediately to build that relationship. Oh, David said he'd do something and he doesn't.
That's right. That's right. Yep. That's another big part of it. It also gives them, so they go to the workshop, they walk away with a piece of paper, they put the piece of paper down on their desk and it gets buried. But instead, they go to the workshop, they walk away, the next day they have an email in their inbox with something else that's useful. So it also acts as that little ping, quite literally, saying, you just experienced this, and I'm the one who helped you experience it. Any other questions before I go on? Is this useful?
I'll just add one more thing, too. I'll put myself back on mute. But I'm also a big believer in not giving away anything for nothing. But a lot of times when I find out that the executives that I'm dealing with, if I know one of their favorite charities, I say, look, don't pay me anything. This is we'll try through all this whole process. But just write a check for, $300 or $400 or $500 to, and whatever charity I know that they like to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It develops relationships with these people right away. They like doing it. It's a win-win for both of us, and it lets them know right away that I don't give anything away for nothing. But they don't see that as a cost.
Right. Yeah, that's an excellent point. I've done that a number of times. And the other thing that I've done that I do since you brought up building relationships, and honestly, that is 80% of what getting work is about for me. It's about building these relationships. I do the workshop with them. I write to them 6 weeks, 2 months later and say, hey, how's it going? Have you managed to put together those story circles that we talked about? Have you managed to do this? Is there anything that I can do to help you? And then I'll give them a phone call because that furthers the relationship. Other thoughts or comments?
This is Mark. I love what you just shared because there's a very strong value exchange of trust that goes through that as well. It doesn't have to be a value exchange of money, but the fact that, you know, you're building that relationship and demonstrating that you're reliable, I think, lends to some of the credibility of what you're trying to do. So that's mm-hmm. a great suggestion.
Another basic part of building that relationship is spend some time on the company's website. Show that you actually did some research ahead of time. Every time I do some work for an organization, I spend time looking for their mission, their vision, the things that they really place importance on, and make sure that I incorporate that or at least refer to it and say, hey, you know, one of you said that one of your core values is listening to your employees, and I think that's fantastic, whatever it may be. Giving them some way of knowing both that I've done my homework and that I find them already to be admirable. I won't work for a company that I don't find admirable in some way, at least. Right after, a few weeks after the Gulf oil spill, I was contacted by one of the organizations involved in that. And they actually wanted me to come in and help them think about how they could craft stories around what had happened. They were looking for a spin doctor. And they offered me a lot of money and I turned it down. I couldn't do it. To this day, I still have kind of mixed feelings about it because it would have been a really nice paycheck. But I also know that it is important to me that I find that I don't work with groups that I find ethically uncomfortable. So it is sometimes a challenge. But when I do my homework, when I go in and I can say, these are things that I genuinely admire about you, that helps build the relationship too. Anything else, or may I go on? I want to talk a little bit before I go on to the other things that some of the other things that I do to get work or to contact people about perceived value. And let me interject that I should add, it's not, I don't want you to think that I'm making, you know, $500,000 a year doing this. I'm not. What I have managed to do is I have relatively steady work, and I'm doing things that I'm passionate about. And that's, for all of us, what we're trying to do is build a life that we find has meaning. And for me, what this is ultimately all about is having a life with meaning. And so doing this organizational work is deeply meaningful to me because it helps me, if nothing else, carry out Brother Blue's mission of how can we hurt each other when we know each other's stories. So I get to go into these organizations and talk about listening and the value of story and how they can craft this. And yeah, they might want to be talking about it because they want to do a better marketing message, but in the midst of it, they have to listen to one another and build relationships with one another. So people walk out of these workshops changed in some fundamental ways often. And that's where the meaning really lies for me and how I am able to remain comfortable with taking this incredibly powerful tool that's a basic part of what it is to be human and monetizing it. So I know that I'm doing good work in the world. All right.
Great.
So, yeah. So perceived value. It's really difficult for some of us to draw the line in the sand around I'm not going to do work for free because an organization that you believe in passionately will contact you, they'll ask you to do something, and they'll say, oh, we don't have any money. But they have some money. They will have something set aside, and they will value the work that you bring them more if they pay you a little bit for it. It's not entirely about you charging them. It's about them paying you, because then they find that there's value in it. They find that there is they've had to cough up something to get this. And so they're more likely to market it more effectively throughout the organization, to listen more deeply to what you have to say, and to believe that you are more of an expert than they might if you give it away for free. There's a story that I believe was written by Douglas Adams that relates to this. So I'm going to tell you just a tiny little story in the midst of all these other personal stories. There was once a city that was bright and prosperous. Everyone had plenty of work. Most people did what they loved. People had homes and enough to eat, and everyone was delighted with their lives. One day, a hunched old woman shuffled into the town square, dragging with her a cart and on that cart were eight huge volumes, eight huge books. And she called out, "All of the wisdom in the world. I will sell you all of the wisdom in the world for one bag of gold." And people laughed at her. "A bag of gold? Are you out of your mind? Why should we give you a bag of gold? We have everything we need. We do not need your wisdom." "Very well," said the woman. She lit a fire and tossed into that fire four of those volumes. And the people watched, uncomfortable, though they couldn't have said why, as those four books hissed and crackled and burned, becoming sparks shooting up to the sky. She took her cart and she left. And the city continued, at first in fine high times, but then things began to change. Work wasn't quite as common. People became somewhat less prosperous, though still most of them had a place to live, and most of them had enough to eat, and most of them had work that they at least could manage to do to get by. And after 5 years, into the town square again came that old woman, dragging behind her her cart with four great volumes upon it. She stood in the town square and called out, "Half of all the wisdom in the world. I will sell you half of all the wisdom in the world for 10 bags of gold." And the people gathered together and said, "But we don't have 10 bags of gold. And last time you were here, it was all the wisdom for only a bag of gold." And she shrugged. "Times change," she said. "Well, we don't have that much money, and it's not worth it anyway." And they were uncomfortable as she built the fire and tossed two of those remaining four volumes on. They watched as the pages were consumed one by one, each glowing red and settling into ash and the sparks shooting into the sky. Again, she took her cart and dragged it away. And things continued to change in the city. People began to fall on hard times. Soon there were people who didn't have homes, who were living in the streets. Others were starving. Many people had work, but so many did not like what they did. And the elders of the city did not know what to do. And 5 years later, the woman came back to the city. "One quarter of all the wisdom in the world, one quarter of all the wisdom in the world for 50 bags of gold." And they came to her and said, "But we do not have it." "Very well." She lit the fire. She tossed one of the remaining volumes in. And everyone was silent as it was consumed by the flames. And things continued to get worse. Time passed and more people were hungry. The children were starving. And the woman came back, cradling in her arms, not even pulling the cart, the one remaining volume. And she stood there. The elders of the village walked up to her, and she didn't have to say a word. And they said, "How much does it cost?" What we have, what we do as storytellers, is unbearably valuable. And if we undervalue it, why should anyone else value it? It is important that you understand the value of what you do and that you believe in your ability to help the organizations with whom you work. And then charge appropriately. I'm not suggesting that you charge 50 sacks of gold for a quarter of your wisdom, but don't charge one sack of gold for all of it either. Make sure that what you are asking for is commensurate with what you are going to give them, and also somewhat equivalent with what other practitioners are doing. It's important that we have the conversations with each other around money, and that's a whole other phone call. But we tend to be rather secretive about money, so don't hesitate to call someone. You can call me if you want and say, "Hey, I have this gig. What would you charge for it?" You also have to take into account where you are, how long you've been doing it, so on and so forth. But in the interest of transparency, the next set of work that I'm doing with Quest Diagnostics, I'm doing what will amount to just over 3 hours of workshop time with them, with a fair bit of prep time. They're paying for my travel, hotel, food, et cetera, and I'm charging them $5,000 for it. I'm probably charging them too little. They didn't blink when I asked for that, which is a way of knowing that you probably are charging too little. Any responses to that?
Yes, this is Mark Stone.
No, go ahead.
I agree with exactly what you say, and there's value in what we do as storytellers, just like there's value in what coaches do for executive members of the team, and what trainers do for other teams and team buildings and things like that. And it's important to know not just what storytellers charge, but what others charge and do in that light as well, because I think you would find that that gives you a strong barometer.
This is Mark. I have a reaction, and I have a feeling I know what some of what you're going to say, but my first reaction is yikes. Holy moly.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying. Absolutely. So when I was starting out in this, actually just performing, I had a long conversation with Michael Parent about what to charge. And he gave me some really good advice. He said, all right, how much would you charge? He gave me a number of scenarios for A, B, and C. And each time what he said was double it. And each time I said, are you kidding? I'm going to throw up if I ask for that much. And his response was, you can always negotiate down. You cannot negotiate up.
Yeah.
So if you say some price that's a hefty chunk of change, and they and there's that long, painful silence, and they say, that's well beyond our budget, then what I always respond with is something like, I really want to work with you, and you understand that this is how I make my living, so let's talk about it. Talking about money is incredibly uncomfortable. I hate doing it, but I've made myself practice it and become better at it. And let me tell you, quite honestly, men are far better at this than women much of the time. But I've made myself practice it, and that way I can have that conversation. So if I'm working with a nonprofit, they want me to do a workshop, and I say, well, typically for this, for nonprofits, because my rates are different for nonprofits than for-profits, I would charge $1,250. And they say, that exceeds our training budget for the entire year. And then when I say, okay, I'd like to do this work with you. And what I also do is I preface it with, I usually say, I'm going to tell you what I would like to be paid for this, what I think my time is worth. However, if this is not an appropriate figure for you, I'd rather talk about it than have you write me off entirely. So I open the door to the conversation before the conversation even starts. So I just did some work for the Johnson County Library System. I did a 90-minute workshop with their youth librarians. And I got this gig because I did a 20-minute talk at the Urban Libraries Council on storytelling. And when they called me and asked me if I could do this is Johnson County, Kansas, so I didn't have to travel or anything. They asked what I would charge for it. And I said, well, typically for this workshop, because I don't have to travel, and because you're a library, I told them that I would charge them $1,000 for it, which is probably less than I should be asking, but I really want a foot in the door there. And she said, look, our entire budget for this event is $750, and I need to be able to feed people. And I said, okay, so how about $500, and you can get me and you introduce me to the director of the library system, to which she agreed. So I now have a meeting set up with the director of the library system, which would have been very difficult to get otherwise. Mm-hmm. And then she called me a week before the workshop and said, I've been thinking about it, and I realized that I can pay you $500 now, and we can roll the other $500 into the next calendar year. So come to me with two invoices. Now, had I said $500 off the bat, I'd have made $500. Had I said $1,000 and insisted, then I wouldn't have had the gig. As it is, I'm actually getting what I want, and I'm getting to meet the director of the library system because I was willing to have the conversation.
Laura, this is Tricia speaking, and I think we're talking to the same clients. Not exactly, but I've had many, many similar conversations. I have a good friend who's actually been very helpful coaching me about how to do just what you're saying. Come out with a number that you feel is honest, you know, in terms of the value of your time. And again, many times people don't know really what it takes to put together a three-hour whatever, you know. It's always customized today. You know, you really don't do too much that's off the shelf. It's always got to be about them, and that makes sense. But I've had similar situations where I worked with a client, and I did ask for a certain number. They fell off their chairs. They came back, and I did negotiate for a lesser fee. it's funny though, after it was done, one of my internal, she was a colleague of mine as well as a client, and she said, you know, you were worth the higher fee.
Mm-hmm.
I saw what you did for us. You were worth that. So, but I have a relationship with them now, and that's fine. But I'm delighted to hear you talking about this because it is a hard one for us in this.
It is. And revealing what we charge is incredibly uncomfortable. I'm sweating. I'm sitting here thinking, oh, my God, am I naming numbers that you guys all think are preposterous? Someone has to start.
Yeah,
and my philosophy has always been, if I think somebody should do something, I remind myself that I am someone.
Yeah, wow.
So.
Well, I think that's very powerful, and I thank you for sharing that with us. And you've also been very clear that, you know, when you're looking at an organization, you're looking, you know, they may have greater resources. And I've also worked for libraries and nonprofits, and we are willing to do, you know, negotiate with them. You know, and I think that, you know, you're being very upfront about that.
Mm.
Yeah,
you're welcome. It's one of those things I have to be careful of because there are cultures where it's wildly inappropriate to be that upfront about the money talk.
Yeah.
So I try and know ahead of time, and I've messed it up sometimes. But this is how I make my living, and it's a way to remind the potential client of the perceived value. And again, it's about building that relationship. It's about building trust. And by being upfront about it, then they know that there's value with what they're getting, and they're more likely to talk about you, which means that you're more likely to get the work.
Yeah, and thank you, Laura, for your candor there, your openness, and your ideas. Well, we're moving in towards the end of the call. So were there any other tips? I know social media was something
right.
In our title. Do you want to touch on that?
Sure. So I have to preface this with, what I'm about to tell you, I have pretty much violated every single one of these rules since the election and the week preceding the election. And I'm not trying to open up a conversation about politics, but that I'm owning that my personal response to the election has had potentially a negative impact on my social media power as in terms of getting work. So just bear in mind that I'm admitting that upfront. So there's an enormous amount of social media out there. And part of what you need to decide as an individual is you need to do some research and figure out what is going to be the most effective social media platform for you. Because there's so much that unless you decide to be a full-time social media manager, you're not going to be able to do all of it. Facebook is the 800-pound gorilla. You need to have a professional Facebook page that you maintain, that you update, that you make an effort to pimp. I've done a good job with my performative page. My Think Story page I've let sit, and I'm going to wait for a little longer before I start really trying to get it noticed because I've kind of spent some of my social media capital because of the ways that I've been personally verbal about the election. That was a choice that I made. It was a conscious choice that I made, and that a lot, you know, is in the same alignment with choosing to turn down that gig that would have paid me a lot of money because it would have violated my sense of personal integrity. The big thing about social media is you need to be consistent. You need to post things regularly, and you need to post things that will have real value, not just, hey, you should hire me because I'm great, but all those clickbaity things, 6 tips to lose weight, whatever it may be. That clickbaity stuff works because it works. If you see, I'm about to publish a blog post tomorrow that's, what did I title it? Hang on, I can actually tell you the title in a moment. I have found that titles like, I'm stalling for time here. Come on. 6 ways to keep your story relevant in a changing world. That will get more response than if I'd simply said how to keep your story relevant in a changing world. So you have to be mindful about things like that. I found my newsletter is a really powerful tool. I don't have an enormous mailing list. I have maybe 1,400 people on my mailing list. But every single time I try and include content that is valuable. So again, it's all about offering something of worth in whatever medium you're choosing to speak through. And presenting yourself as an expert. You are experts in this. You may not feel like it, but you are. which leads to the last thing that I just wanted to touch upon, which was back to ethics, which is if you are approached to do a job that you really have no clue how to do, or that you know you would do a poor job with, we need to remember to be generous with one another. And I have and will continue to pass jobs on if I know that I am not able to at least be competent about it. And that's not just because I'm trying to be generous to my fellow practitioners, but because I need to protect my reputation. And I need to protect our reputation, because if I go in and do a crappy job at a gig, no longer, not only will they say, well, you know, we hired her, but she wasn't that great, and not recommend me, but they may have a decreased view of our practice as a whole. And so I think that's part of my responsibility.
Yeah. One quick question, you know, to build your mailing list up to 1,400, what percentage is of that, it was like people who opted in versus people that you work for and you just put on the list?
It's entirely opt-in. Let me rephrase that. I never put anyone on my list who has not given me explicit permission. So I have, for example, if I'm going to email out a handout to a bunch of individuals, what I say to them is, please fill this out. Please give me your email address. I will email you the handout. I'd like to add you to my mailing list, but if you put the word no next to your email address, I will not. So it is all at least tacitly opt-in. I've never added anyone to my list who didn't know that they were going to get it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because I hate being added to lists. It makes me crazy when people do that without asking me first.
Great. Well, Laura, this has been quite a session. I know everyone really appreciates what you had to say and to help us think about our own careers and the own ways that we get work. Are there any final questions before we end the call?
Then let me add, if a question comes up later, please don't hesitate to email me, or if you need to ask questions like, how much would you charge? I will have that conversation with you. I'm happy to.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. We really appreciate that. I appreciate that personally, and we as a group. Laura, great call. Thanks for taking the Sunday afternoon with us. And everybody have a great rest of your weekend.
Have a good Thanksgiving,
thank you,
everybody.
Laura. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. I hope it was useful.
Thank you.
Very useful.
Yes, it was
thank
very
you.
Useful. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks, Laura.